today wanted to look at what happens when we look at two deaf communities. And so it's not just the idea of culture, because the question is, what is culture? Is culture so ubiquitous, so widespread that if you are in the culture, the deaf culture, or in a school system or a larger system that is dealing with these deaf hearing issues, what are the similarities and differences if you're in one part of the world and another part of the world? Well, an interesting snapshot of two different deaf communities and the degree to which they seem similar and dissimilar regarding this question of deaf and hearing. So that's kind of where we would go today. Also some talking about the idea of social justice in terms of what happens when you begin to work with cultures and community, and what right do you have tinkering with them in the first place, and what direction do you intend to take them, and what are some of the bases for those. So with that as kind of preamble, some ideas that are still hanging on from yesterday and the day before, or questions that you may have, or issues that you think seem to popped up for you that made some sense. Yeah.
Question about yesterday, we talked a little bit about WSD and the research you had done,
right,
the project you had done at WSD, and I assume today we're going to talk about another similar one.
Yep.
Your occasion for going there, was it out of the nature to settle conflict, or was it? It was.
Well, it was. This is an ongoing question that when invited to work with like WSD or any number of places I land up working with, there's a. I have done this enough that I know that there is always a struggle between three things. Awareness, that should be an end. Awareness, design, and skill building. What happens normally, put an I in there, is that some organizations have, or groups or individuals, will find themselves in a position where, out of just sheer exhaustion, they've tried all the other alternatives, competitive and others, and now they're looking for some other way to manage their conflict. And what will happen oftentimes is that they'll come and say, well, all we need to do is have our skills built in the area of cooperative problem solving, or we need to negotiate better, or we need to understand how to do it better. which is the skill building mode. The problem with that is, if invited in to do that in the absence of a design in the organization, meaning a structural design in which those skills are going to take place, it feels real good for a very short period of time, and then it falls apart because there's nothing in the organization to perpetuate it. And prior to that, then, is even the notion of awareness. Where does that dawn break for organizations, groups, cultures, countries, governments, where they recognize that they've got to make some kind of a change, that they no longer can go ahead and do things the way they have? And so one of the first assessments you have to make, whether it's coming into WSD or, for instance, in Ontario, where I was just about a year ago, is what are they asking you to do, and as opposed to what is it that they need to do. The vast majority of times is they've heard the conflict, they'll call it conflict resolution. Give me conflict resolution skills because we don't know how to conflict inside of our organization. And my struggle is to say, no, let's look to see what you've got in your organization as a design to see how you're going to build those skills into the organization so that there'll be some kind of long-lasting But it's not just organizations or communities, it's countries as well. In 90 and 91, as Poland was reconstructing its constitution, it still is, but as they were beginning the process of saying, all right, we've made this huge shift out of the communist system into a new system, and we're not quite sure what it is, but it's going to be different than what it was in the past. I had the opportunity to work with some of the people from the Constitutional Committee in Poland who were writing the Constitution, and had the opportunity to review the first English translation draft that had four or five variants as they were attempting to pull together, because they needed to prepare an English draft in order to present to Geneva as an initial condition to be considered for associate status for the European community. So I had the chance to read it in a very kind of primordial state, purposely to be able to look at it and say, okay, now if you're going to build something, this is design in a mega fashion. If you're going to design a system that is going to manage your conflict, if you think of constitutions as doing it, what can you do to go ahead and design it in a more cooperative way? In other words, to begin to look for what are extraneous. Remember yesterday I mentioned there's two types of competition, extraneous and inherent. Well, the idea that oftentimes when we write documents attempting to go ahead and manage societies and people, we assume wrongly that we need to build into these things a competitive design for disputing when there's really no necessary push to do it. So can you modify some things at the front end? That's a great opportunity to be able to support a design for the skill building that will take place. Poland was in a situation where they recognized that this was a critical window of opportunity as the Constitution was beginning to gel, as they were able to play with different options and opportunities, that over that course of that 2 years, 18 months or 2 years, you would have been able to make changes and modifications that would be far more difficult once you actually brought it together and it now became a living document. The skill building then of the individuals has to flow from the design. And the question of awareness is not so much where the awareness comes from, whether it's at the end of exhaustion of a group or an organization, or whether it's at the front side. So it's not, as long as that awareness is there, first of all, that design and skill building needs to be created, then that's where I kind of come in. But the argument is the same. I can predict it no matter where it happens. And it happens in private corporations as well as public systems. I've lost several opportunities to make a lot of money by not being willing to go in and say, well, we'll just simply go in there, yeah, let's give these skills to these people and do it that way with no shift in the organization. Because what you'll do is you'll turn a huge number of people off, because when they try the skill and they don't have an organizational backing to it, it extinguishes the behavior. And I don't like to spend my time doing that kind of stuff. But that's the critical issue between those three. In terms of WSD, for instance, the interesting part of dealing with the whole question of the deaf community, way back when I began to work with them in Boston, is that I had the sense that what was happening was the awareness question was really at the front side. They were already becoming prescient of the difficulty it is going to take to get from a condition where you have a hearing-dominated system of teaching and training deaf children to one where there's some type of a rebalancing or a balancing of the system so that the deaf become empowered to be able to make some decisions that they haven't been able to. Well, in order to be able to make that shift, the recognition is it isn't going to be easy. Well, can we begin the process by saying what are some of our options rather than assuming we've got only competitive, hardcore, knockdown, drag out, divisive wars that need to take place between the hearing and the deaf. And then we'll go through this competitive design, see who's standing at the end of the contest, and then we'll know who wins and who loses. There's got to be a better way, and there is a better way. And so it's been part of the fascination for working with the deaf and the hearing communities. The fascination, once again, also is that there seems to be this intriguing echo of design and intent, whether it's in Boston or New York or Ontario or the state of Washington. So there seems to be this kind of gathering social shift that I talked about on Wednesday, that there are plates that are moving in the earth that are difficult to detect, and you only see them in kind of bits and pieces. I've had a unique opportunity just simply by luck of history and geography to have had the opportunity to kind of see this constant. And so it's kind of a very intriguing question on my part. So I'm trying to understand it better and then trying to explain it better, because I think if we all have a better understanding of what are some of these movements that are going on and some of the options, we may be able to have a true shift in social systems in a positive, cooperative, non-competitive way. It doesn't mean it's not hard. It is. It's difficult. But the outcome is has an opportunity for being durable because the relationships that are so necessary to run the entire show need to remain intact. The deaf need the hearing. The hearing need the deaf and the deaf community in terms of the deaf education. That what constitutes an integration of those two different cultures and the construction of something completely new, whatever you call it. This is an opportunity. So, other questions? Yes.
Well, so it may be a single issue that raises the awareness to the greater need of an infrastructure to support this safe arena. It's a healthy arena to work through the issues. Do you find most organizations need kind of a Saturn experience where they start from the ground up and build, or because there's just too much dysfunction, or are some organizations have some of the components and you can build and construct, or is it just a real hodgepodge out there?
Well, it is. It's more of a hodgepodge because it some organizations who feel that they've been very good in the way in which they've been carrying out conflict. The term good turns out to be a difficult term because it means that they don't see much of it. And so it's we're back to that whole avoidance question. And then one of the things that we know, that when you know that there's going to be a conflict, when you've got the interdependency, you've got the perception of incompatible goals, and you feel or see that someone is blocking, one of the outcomes is going to have to be that you're going to have to make a decision about what to do about this issue of avoidance. Either that you go deeper in the avoidance or that you try some other strategy, but you can't stay where you are. And so the sense of threat to the organization, the constant is the organization feels threatened. When an organization is able to go ahead and pull itself out of that and say, we don't need to be, in fact, we are now going to go ahead and participate and find a strategy in order to be able to go together, now we see things happening in a very positive way. But yes, it comes all kinds of different sizes and shapes. Yes?
So what were some of the specific issues, either in Washington or Ontario, that brought it to an awareness for these schools that they needed to shift, they needed to ask you to come?
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's I often think about that, and I don't have the answers because I don't know enough about the history of all of these institutions. I know a little bit about it, but it almost seems to be, it seems, if I were to draw some common threads, for instance, Boston and Ontario, there's a connection there. I said, I'm kind of an accident of history and geography. Well, I told you how I got involved in the deaf in the first place, and that was because of the Palestinian question. This one woman who was part of the Palestinian dialogue, Anita Small, who had just started working with the Learning Center for Deaf Children in Boston, turns out that she's from Ontario, Canada, and her husband is Canadian. And they had been working in the Boston area. Then as she was working with the Learning Center for Deaf Children, she and Marie Phillips, who was a very strong advocate for the deaf community and recognized nationwide, they were a very powerful team. Anita was hearing, Maria was deaf. They're both good writers, good researchers, very powerful tandem. In fact, began to do some seminars together and talking about the issue, and wanted to raise the awareness. We're on that awareness side. They were the ones who I think, if the little I know about it, were the ones who were bringing that awareness in front of people to say, we do have the data, we have the research, we know that there is a deaf culture, we can't hide it any longer. It is potent, it's robust, it has its own language, it has its own rhythm, it has its own series of social events and values. We know it's different, we know the language is different. Now, how do we go ahead and stop the fantasy of saying we now teach children as if no deaf culture exists, or just take it from the medical model that we need to take deaf kids because they need to be fixed? And how do we modify that whole process? Well, so they said, and if that is true, it will start here in Boston, or at least we'll do what we can do here in Boston. 3 years later, Anita's husband gets another position back in Toronto. She goes back to Toronto. She starts working with the deaf community. Okay, discovers in the same sense an initial discussion going on again among the three deaf schools around the Toronto area. She, knowing of my work in Boston, invites me to come to Ontario. So I become part of the infection. You know, I kind of now bring the, but I'm not leading. I'm simply trying to support them to ask the same questions that they were asking in Boston. And here you had Anita, and as it turned out, a strong pool of other individuals who were like-minded, recognizing the same things. But it was, so it's not the question that something was invented. It's the issue that something got on top of the table that had been underneath the table for a long time. And something happens in our social histories that brings a curious connection together that seems to stimulate that. New York, Same thing. They had heard about some of the work we had done in Boston. They understood exactly what was going on. Their fight was a little different because now it was a question of mainstreaming and funding from the state of New York. So theirs was much more of a political question right off the top. They needed to make some decisions about how they were going to present themselves to the state, so it had a different impulse there again. And then, lo and behold, I get a phone call from Washington to ask how that connection was made. You would probably have to ask Grace to my right here, or Lori, or the others here, because how those connections were made in identification, I'm not exactly certain. But the long and short of it was, I had the same opportunity. The mistake that one of the mistakes I could make, especially coming from outside of the deaf community, is to assume that the deaf community in Boston was the same thing as the deaf community in Washington or in Ontario. I couldn't, because I needed to understand why each one of those organizations was unique. And then the question comes, going back to the issue that Larry raised, do I come in and I solve a specific problem, or is it a question of organization? I'm being invited again in 2 weeks' time to sit down with the people again in Washington, but the question is exactly the same. This conversation that Grace and I had last night, same thing we've had in the past, is what is the expectation of the organization right there? Is it on one side, are there specific issues that we need to grapple with, and can I help them in understanding how to be able to uncover it, get inside of those issues, and seek some cooperative long-term agreements? I do that often. My role as a negotiator and a mediator, that's what I'm called in to do. But that's very different than if, in fact, the needs of the organization is one of saying, no, what we really need is we need much more specific organizational and personal skills to be able to now go ahead and attach to this design that we have been doing, so that when they come, when the conflicts come, which you know that they will, that arena will already be addressed. People will know what it is, they will know what the process is, and they will have some skills better than they have now, how to be able to address those conflicts. With the assumption, and maybe not just the assumption, hopefully with some experience, that if they are able to deal with that in a more cooperative way, the outcomes are more delicious. Because they are not fraught with having to make that scariest of all decisions. Do I win and lose my friends, or do I lose and lose my self-esteem? And so, how do you take people off of that dilemma, that impossible dilemma? Other questions? Can I ask a question, because we have people from Washington School for the Deaf? How did you find me? I mean, I just... It's a good question. It would be interesting for me to go on.
She's good. My recollection, there were some people who were involved with Grace, and they made a lot of calls, and we interviewed several different people. And there was a small group of us who decided that, given our problems at school, we needed a negotiator, or, you know, a person who was not knowledgeable with us, an outsider. And we needed someone who had the background with the deaf community, yes, and who had skills with the negotiations. And I remember Grace sat in a lot of meetings and called a lot of people and made lots of calls and finally found Tom.
What were the problems at school that brought to you that realization that you needed a negotiator?
Oh, first, there's a huge list. I think it was really, needing to wake up people, to wake people up, because we were really stressed out all the time. Our trust levels, it was not there. No, there was no trust in our community. Organization itself sucked. Simple.
It's a technical term.
The communication problems were coming up frequently, all the time. Chris is saying yes. And, many people as teachers, teachers' aides, were complaining or whatever, and to the superintendent, that we didn't feel as if we were being heard.
And I sort of, this is just my perspective too, I feel like it really got much more intense once we started working on the bye-bye issue. I think that's what finally brought it to a head in kind of a recognizable way. Bilingual, bicultural, there was a much more focused attempt to say that we are a school that uses American Sign Language as opposed to Sign English. That brought up, I think, in some of the older staff, of feeling of being threatened because of their experience having gone through sign English. It brought up just a lot more different issues. And it seemed like that started off maybe uniting groups in a little more separate way. Are they becoming more definite? Separate group. It's hard. Before, people just sort of had rumblings, and then finally, I think more people took a stand to say, "No, American Sign Language is what we should be using. We need to more directly address the issue of deaf culture in the classroom and have it be a much more focused idea at our school." And just in my opinion, that's what things just come to a head. As much as there always had been problems with the organization and all of that, in my opinion, I saw it as that the working toward the bye-bye, it became apparent that there were two cultures, or if we were not letting people deny the issue anymore. And I just see that as having really caused a lot of it. Started a lot, not caused, but started.
I would like to add to that also that people like me who, recently arrived there just a couple of years ago, I'm young and I'm, I haven't been working for 20 to 25 years, and so I'm not willing to bow down to the organization, and I'm not going to be a hypocrite. Education has changed. It's changed. And it's going to continue to change. And it's like, I can't teach like they did in the past. Forget it! I just can't, I saw some of the education in the elementary and junior high school, and I just pretended, all the way through, oh yeah, sure, mm-hmm. So, what did I learn? Nothing, no. I have to be real with the kids, and I have to teach them. So, there was also that issue. And it caused some separation. Almost two generations are there at that school. You know, some were like, oh, come on, we have 5-6 years left, just keep going and make it. And other people were, no, this is serious, let's change it now. The kids need it. And so there was a lot of disparity between the two.
Larry, I
was just curious how much the deaf community is aware of and or a part of that conflict outside of the school itself.
Can anybody respond to that?
In that group that, no, I'm not signing. Thank you. In that group that Lori was talking about, there are 14 people in this group, and there were 7 hearing and 7 deaf. Those people came from the school and the community. And the community's perspective about our school and our school needs were the same as ours. There was no surprises. It was just a thrilling time to take a critical look at ourselves. And it was, I would agree with Eileen, because of the bye-bye issue that had been stirring in our community. And the one thing that none of us have said yet, we all cherish our community, though we all have tremendously different perspectives and experiences there. And so with that, that's the hook that keeps us going and willing to go through these discussions that indeed are very painful, because we have to come up with different ways of behaving, and we have to continue to clarify our arena. Our year now has been with the outside community people's help, is recognizing that they have even additional issues than the 198 were the issues numbered that we came up with that committee of 14 with the help of outside and internal questionnaires and surveys and whatnot. And those outside people then are going to have us address other issues after we go through this clarification of thought on the major issues of where, in fact, do the two cultures come in contact and have conflict? And where, in fact, do the two cultures come in contact and have harmony? So that's, and we're almost ready to have that discussion. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
My role is to help with the process. And those organizations who can recognize the need for that kind of support outside of what the specific issue is, seem to be able to handle that conflict better, because they understand that separation, that as intense as the issue may become, if you don't have the process support, the choice to avoid is always too seductive. And it's seductive because there is not an arena identified in which that specific dispute can take place. So in very practical terms, the time I had with WSD a year ago, I teach my circle model for dispute, which is just a model, a teaching model that I've used in a number of different arenas and cultures and nations and whatnot. And it seems to work. But not just to discuss it theoretically, we would use it in front of everybody to show, okay, if we have one issue, you had a deaf person and you're a hearing person, how could you apply a very simple communication model? I don't mean to make it simple, it's not simplistic, but how can you use one that if we can carry the discipline of that process, you can get from an initial sense of disputing to an outcome where you've got some agreements and you feel that you can accept those agreements because you've taken a process that was not competitive. And so if we can reiterate that, if we can set up echoes in the organization so that instead of just using it as a as one template, how would you use it if you were in a committee? How would you use it if you're talking to your boss? How would you use it if you've got a dispute in the class? If you want to find the organizations and the schools where the greatest change and shift, the social shift, is going to take place, is where you see something like mediating, the ability to identify neutral parties to support other people in their disputing. Okay. That it's not just done for the students, that's the way the teachers do it. And that's, in fact, the way the administrators do it. Because then it becomes a modeling effect up and down the line. It's not just the way those people do it. It is, in fact, a mode of learning and an important one. I mentioned this, I'm not sure here, someplace else, by the year 2000, 50% of all the school systems in Minnesota will have active mediation programs in them. 50%. Here's this cloud of students who are coming through our universities expecting that that's the way it's going to be done, expecting that kind of a cooperative system for carrying out their benefits. So it's this push that now the institutions have to design something in order to take care of this general awareness. Same thing in any kind of a community. How redundant is that same system as a way to be able to deal with disputes? Yes, Connie.
You started a couple days ago by saying frequently you're chosen because of what you are not.
Precisely.
You are as neutral as possible.
I am like the wind. Yes.
The
French have a great term for it. They call media to nude. The nude mediator just walks in unclothed, handles the process, puts his clothes back on. It's a French for you, but I just thought I'd just...
Have you felt frustration or resistance because you can't do that here? You can't be not deaf or not hearing?
This is an ongoing discussion of what constitutes neutrality and unbiasedness. Nobody can be totally unbiased or totally neutral. So there are conditions that people have to accept as initial conditions. I am hearing, and that's not a fault, nor is it a praise. It is simply a condition. I feel extremely, not frustrated at all. Matter of fact, I feel incredibly fortunate because I think I've had a practical education like few people have. I mean, when I say, I don't know if you've ever seen Marie Phillips, for instance, or met her. When they decided to bring me into Boston and they knew I had no experience with the deaf, she sent me reams of data, reports, research, writings, books, and things like this for my homework, and then brought me in a day before I actually began meeting with the staff so that she and her cohort, Anita, could, for a full day, kind of walk me through the practical reality. I mean, that's where I got the social training, the do's and don'ts, in a very instructive way and very pointed. It was opening the door. It was the introduction. It was, and it was kind of brought in and in shades, you know, to see. So I didn't go ahead and make inadvertent mistakes. And it was, so it was a wonderful education. I don't know what it means to be deaf. I don't, I'm just, the glimmer is just beginning to be there by virtue of the opportunity that I've had. So it's still a wonderment for me. And I learn a little bit more every time I have a chance to meet him again. But I never think of coming into a role where, in fact, I'm totally unbiased and totally neutral. I have a responsibility of disclosure. It's pretty obvious I'm hearing, but I also need to disclose to people that, that I don't have a history with deaf people. That prior to 1989, I was as naive as anybody else. But it's the same thing you do as if you're walking into any kind of a mediation. My responsibility as the mediator is to make sure you understand what my background is and what my past interactions have been with the people who are at the table. And then if that's okay with them, then fine, we move on. We move on from there. Also, sometimes that works to the other side. In Poland, for instance, my accessibility to doing what I was doing was not that I spoke Polish, because I don't, but I had a Polish surname, and my parents are Polish, my grandparents. That's all they needed to know. So that when I was invited to Poland, I didn't have to pay the visitor's tax, because if you didn't spend enough money in Poland in 1989, for the time you were there, you'd have to pay the money in order to get out. But it, and one of the reasons for this was because people from with Polish surnames were supplying about a third of the GNP of Poland since the 1940s and early 1950s, and so they didn't want to discourage Americans coming in to support their relatives. So I had this kind of, and but once you reach that certain level of acceptance, then they look at the other things, like Lori was saying, okay, what does he know or what has he done that can help us support us right here now? Okay, so that's over with. Now you're in a different arena. Now what can you do for me? And I always expect that anytime you're in that kind of an interaction. So where it takes me regarding my role with the deaf and the hearing in the future, I don't have a clue. This is not something I'm looking far in the future and saying that I know where it's going to go. It will take whatever level, hopefully, is necessary and appropriate. Can I? Yes.
I have to ask a very dumb, elementary question. I'm a little confused when you talked about bye-bye, and then there was a reference shortly thereafter between signed English and ASL. What is this conflict? I mean, I thought it was between the hearing community and the deaf community. I hear something about signed English versus ASL. I need a little help.
Can I just frame it for you, then either people here can answer that far better than I, okay? We're back to that difference between a conflict that happens internally inside of a culture and the conflict that happens externally. What the internal conflict, the various reactions, for instance, to this notion of bilingual, bicultural, as Eileen mentioned. You're talking about that internal, what happens when you've got a culture, you have got a specific event or issue that now goes ahead and cleaves the culture, forces the culture itself to make some decisions about how people are going to react to it. And then division takes place based on the perception of that initial issue. Who would like to respond to that? How would you define it?
Okay, now I grew up hearing, well, oral. And when I learned sign, I learned signed English. I was very English signing. That's just how I learned English. I followed signed English until I became more aware of deaf culture, the deaf community. And I sent my children to Washington School for the Deaf, and that's really how I changed more ASL. Now I see a real difference between American Sign Language, ASL, it's real easier to receive that than English. English is, takes much longer time. American Sign Language is easier for children to receive. It's more abbreviated, more condensed. ASL is it's a language. It's a language of deaf people. It is a language. Sign English is not a language. It is you signed in English word order, but for a deaf person who needs to really conceptualize, have pictures presented, for me, at least, it's impossible to follow with English. ASL, you're able to. It gives you pictures quickly. And that's a real difference. Bi-bi, bilingual, bicultural. It supports the idea of teaching, let's say, in a classroom. You don't use your voice, and you only sign.
And then when the child acquires that one language, then they can add the second language as English as their second language. They'll have a foundation. And that's the purpose of that. You know, people are really puzzled and opposed to that idea. Because, well, maybe they pick up their skill level. Some people can't stand not talking at the same time that they're signing. For me, talking at the same time, well, I try to use two languages at the same time, and what happens? I get really confused. I'll drop one and use the other. So signing, I'm not sure if that answers your question or not. Is that more clear?
Could you take it one step further and talk about it on the cultural side? Not just the language side, but the notion of the bicultural, what it means to be, in the sense, straddling two cultures.
Well, I feel the goal is to teach our kids at school about deaf culture and to be proud of their culture. You know, it's okay to be deaf, it's okay to be using your ASL and the other things that would go along with it. There's, to give them a gift, you know, of their or identity, excuse me. And that you can teach about the hearing culture at the same time, you know. Yeah, because many of the children's parents are hearing, so they need to know about the hearing culture. Kids need to be comfortable to be going back and forth between the two cultures. You need that. Do you have anything to add, Chris? For deaf children, you know, they can do the same thing that hearing children can do.
My simple problem then, for me on the outside, is that signed English still seems to be something that belongs to the deaf culture. I hear you saying that ASL equates to deaf culture, but SEE does not.
How would you respond?
No, signed English is not part of the deaf culture. No. We hate it.
Because
yeah,
it's
that
complex.
C started in the 60s or 70s, right? Something around there. ASL was long before that. Signed English From the deaf culture's perspective, it was a way of making deaf children more hearing. You know, so that their English language would be more perfect. Right.
The potency then is it's symbolic of much more than just communication. It's of esteem about who you are. And that's part of the culture.
Right.
And also that's where the threat lies.
And that's where the threat lies. The English, signed English, is more like, I would suspect, makes you feel more like they accommodate. The lose win. And much less the co-promo.
I don't want to disturb this discussion because it's excellent, but I just want to make reference to this, some of this information over here very briefly, because I think it may say something. Once again, we've got the five main strategies for disputing, and what I wanted to compare, and each one of these, was the results from Ontario and the results from Washington. For a couple of reasons. One of the things to look at, and remember the question. The question was, tell me what your organization looks like. Tell me what the strategies that are operating in your organization. So these are responses of my external view. These are not responses of what I do myself. And, I mean, you can analyze this a number of ways, but one of the ways to look at it is that you get, even inside of individual institutions, fairly radical views that are different by parts of that same culture. So, for instance, in Ontario, you've got the hearing group, to a far greater degree, seeing their institution as avoiding issues much more than the bilingual and the deaf, which is a really kind of a curious turn, because it means from the bi and the deaf, those people who, and oh, by the way, when I asked these two very different communities, the proportions were relatively the same of the number of people who considered themselves deaf, hearing, and bilingual. When I say relatively, they were in with about 5 or 6 percentage points of each one, so we had a relative equal scale. But here we've got, for instance, in Ontario and Washington, two different views in some respects of what's happening inside of the organization. The good side is, in terms of Washington, you've got generally everybody feeling a little bit more cohesive regarding their view of the organization. In Ontario, the problem is you've got some, for some reason, the hearing culture inside of that community is seeing their organization very differently than the bi and the deaf. But the two things I want to just quickly point out, though, is look at the response regarding accommodation and regarding compromise as being common elements in both of those communities. Excuse me. That there's strong acceptance of the fact that neither of those communities are seen as accommodating, necessarily. And an accommodating community is one that is inviting, gives a sense of saying, you can move because I'm willing to be flexible. So there's a shared experience of having to move against something rather than move with them. So that seems to be a common element, consistent among hearing by and deaf, hearing by and deaf, Ontario and Washington. And the same thing here regarding compromise. While this is spread a little bit more, in a sense you get very much the same type of response. They don't see their organization as willing or maybe able or capable of compromise. But we do see a big difference in terms of the co-promotion that is perceived in the organization. Where Ontario, the deaf and the bi, see their organization as being much more co-promotive of them and attempting to join them in some kind of equal discussion, except for the hearing. And so we have this interesting kind of, to see that flip there, that the hearing are becoming, and I think the more I'm getting to know that community, the hearing are becoming more and more alienated in terms of their involvement in the deaf community, and that's not good because they need one another in there. There needs to be some way of reconnecting them, seeing the organization as being co-promotive for those hearing who wish to participate in the community, as well as the deaf and maybe this is impossible. You know, maybe that connection is impossible regarding for the hearing. Maybe because their strength of community is getting so strong that by just necessity, the rejection precludes some type of larger community. And there's some very strong logic for that notion that in order to be able to go ahead and build themselves as a community, they need separation. They need to know who they are not part of. And of course, that's the real threat. It's the threat and the fear on the side of the deaf that they are losing their allies, their friends, in order to be able to become part of who they really are. And then, of course, from the hearing side, the sense of rejection is huge. I mean, and it's seminal. I mean, this is not just a tangential thing. That is why the necessity of understanding how to be able to handle those really gut-wrenching disputes in a way that opens up an arena that doesn't make it divisive and competitive is so much more important for them. Because you're not talking about casual distinctions here. You're talking about an identity issue, a really ontology, what is the being of the individual. And fundamentally what you're trying to do is keep them away from dilemmas, from having to choose one or the other, or at least giving them the opportunity to understand why they choose one or the other in a way that the other side can accept. This also, if you can make some other interesting comparisons here. This flip is same, is crossed the same way. But then if you look at this kind of cloud on the Washington side and this kind of cloud over here as far as co-promotion, there's a cohesion regarding how deaf hearing and by see their organization, saw their organization, this is a year old, things change in a year, how they saw their organization a year ago. And at that snapshot in history, clearly those two communities would have seen their organizations different. For me, this is important because if we're going to help support the designing of a more cooperative system, you deal with two very different realities of an organization. And then it would be intriguing to test over time to see what happens in terms of that perception and where those kind of perceptions move. Yes.
Yeah, yesterday you were comparing not just their perception of the organization, but their tones,
yes,
styles. How did that vary from Washington to Ontario?
That I don't have. That information. The only thing I brought with me was the view of the organization to the view of the organization. I don't have Ontario's view of their own style and their organization.